Welcome. It's time for another Diane's Kamikaze Pun Machine podcast. My guest today is Captain Sensible. Yes. How exciting. He's a lot of fun. You will find out all types of interesting things about him, about damned members in the past. And hear that he is really an overall nice guy. Yay. Follow my Twitter posts and Instagram posts at Diane Kamikaze. That is one word, DianeKamikaze. Thanks to Liz Berg for putting this podcast up. And away we go. Here's the captain. I am very pleased to welcome my esteemed guest, Captain Sensible of the Damned, of course. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
Yeah, not too bad. Hello. How are you doing?
We're celebrating, and the Damned is coming over to the stage to do some gigs. And, of course, it is the 40th anniversary of the release of New Rose. How does all the sort of the celebration of punk now strike you 40 years later? I know there was a British Library punk exhibition.
There was, yeah. Well, you feel like a bit of a museum piece, to be quite honest. But I do remember certainly no Elvis, Beatles and Rolling Stones in 1977. So, I mean, the Rolling Stones are still with us, aren't they? So you feel a bit like Carry On to the bitter end, really.
You guys are coming over to do some shows in L.A., and in New York, very, very soon. You're doing are you playing? I know when you were doing your British shows, you were playing all of the first album.
Yeah. They've got us playing this extremely long set, which a career spanning retrospective, I think they've billed it as.
Mm.
So there's been a lot of kind of relearning of songs that you haven't played for blooming years, you know.
Oh.
It's going to be, it goes right across, you know, from the start to the finish. And it's really fun, you know, because we end up playing some, you know, some quite intricate tunes, which gives us a workout, really, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Was it? So,
and,
yes.
And we've got a trumpet player as well.
Oh, really?
He gets a chance to embellish Eloise and Twisted Nerve and what's the other ones?
Something off of
six or seven he plays.
Something
on,
off
yeah.
of Strawberries, really, right? I think.
Yeah.
I can hear the beginning.
It'll come to me on the day.
I'm sure it will. Well, it'll come to him at least. So he'll be there when he needs to. That's awesome. And then I see that as soon as you go home, pretty much you're doing a UK tour also.
Yeah, it's really nice to have this resurgence of interest. You know, I mean, we've been going 40 years, which is like remarkable, really, because you didn't expect it to last more than a few weeks with the volatile characters in the band. You know, I mean, Brian and Rat and Dave, and myself, I suppose, fairly, you know, upbeat characters. And, I mean, making the albums was not easy, I have to say. You know, there's some good old rows and the occasional punch-up. but they all sound different, the records, and they've all got their own flavour. And so out of all that chaos and everything, we left behind some quite good music. I don't know how we did it, really.
And looking back, when you made that first record, you said, like, your outlook, you didn't know what was going to happen that week. Is there a different way when you're writing music, when you really don't care, and then after a while, and you've been in a band for years, is there a particular way that you look at music differently? What's the difference between 1976 and now?
Well, it's, I just look upon it all as being a great musical adventure, you know, from the start when we were doing short, sharp, shock kind of songs, about 2 minutes long and, you know, get your point over quick. And it was kind of like a blitzkrieg from the stage. You know, people used to say, you know, I thought you were going to play so-and-so and song, you know, and I'd tell them, yeah, well, we did. And because it's kind of our gigs were a blur in those days. They didn't, but we didn't like to repeat ourselves. So each album takes on its own kind of sound, really. And if you sit down and try and write raunchy songs, it often turns out to be quite kind of sad, kind of slow songs. So or vice versa. So it's just whatever happens, really. I mean, we, unlike some men, I'm not going to mention any names, we've never done anything with a view to commerciality. You know, it's not. No one ever suggests, oh, this might be a hit record or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You just do whatever you want, whatever you. I mean, not even the record companies had a look in. You know, they'd come down a studio at the end of the recording sessions. They weren't allowed in before then. And the remarkable times, really, to be in a band because you. It was kind of a golden era, really. They let you do whatever you wanted. I mean, no band in the world would ever get into a recording studio now, you know, and do whatever they wanted. I mean, it's just not allowed.
Right.
But in those days, when there was, you know, record companies took risks. I mean, they were taking a risk with us because, you know, I mean, we might have wrecked the studio I think we did a couple of times. but, you know, it might have all imploded and... So they spent, you know, a vast amount of money, and they didn't even end up with a record at the end. So they were great days, and I remember like the all night sessions, till like sort of, you know, till the pubs opened the next day. Then you go down there and have some lunch and a few pints, and you come back and start all over again. I don't think we ever got any sleep. It was that sort of thing, really.
Mm. Is there any record in your career that's as close to a concept record, or what was the best planned out record that you were ever involved in?
Oh, well, Dave started really taking control in the run up to the Black Album, and that's really his baby. I didn't really see it coming, but all of a sudden there were kind of really kind of dark lyrics, and it was kind of, you know, proto goth stuff. And that album's really got a flavour all of its own. It's some great tunes on there. I'm looking forward to playing in a week or so.
Oh yeah, what's the biggest venue that you guys have ever played?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, we've done some, yeah, reasonable sized gigs, but, you know, some of the festivals you play are just massive.
Oh, yes.
I think we did, was it Coachella? And, what was that other one called? Ink and Iron. That was pretty good fun. Down by the Queen Mary.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
And where else? Yeah, we did that Warped Festival, Warped Tour. Yeah, that was good fun too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when they threw the names of the bands into a hat, and like as they pulled them out, you know, you would the first band out of the hat would be the top of the bill, and the second one would be, you know, and carry, like that. So, you know, the headline acts, you know, might have gone on first, or, you know, some of the smaller acts might have gone on last. So. It was really democratic.
Oh, that's neat.
The Warped Tour. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed that one.
Oh, cool. I know you're doing 2 days in New York at the Gramercy, and then you've got an L.A. gig also. When you, when New Rose came out, how good of a musician were you?
Well, I remember, you know, the bloke from Stiff Records used to say, you've got a journalist coming round this afternoon. Hide your Hendrix albums, Captain. So, I mean, I mean, I used to practice and practice in, you know, me Hendrix licks and everything. And I mean, you know, I haven't got a, you know, 1% of the talent he had, but you know, I could play a few impersonations of the bloke. And and you know, of course, when punk came along, nobody wanted guitar solos anymore. So I joined the band anyway as a bass player because Brian was phenomenal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So but anyway, yeah, I could play a bit, but it was really strange. Because it was supposed to be some kind of, you know, year zero, 1977, and you pretend that you hated everything that ever happened before, you know. But I like the Kinks and the Move and the Small Faces and Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Soft Machine and all those other bands. I thought they were brilliant. Oh, there was some boring stuff. It was just excessive kind of rock, kind of nonsense, like... you know, 20-minute drum solos and songs about Wizards and Pixies and, I mean, yes, and Genesis spring to mind. Yeah, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, that sort of thing, you know. It was just getting over the top.
Yes.
And for a bloke living on a council estate, you just couldn't relate to the songs or the lyrics.
What's a council estate?
Know. Oh, it's a council-built estate. Housing estate for working class families.
Oh, got it. Okay.
You know, and a lot of, I mean, I was, you know, unemployed and, you know, and it's a class ridden society in Britain. It still is to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all we ever wanted was to break out of that and try and make something of ourselves. And that's what punk is, really. You're trying to kind of, you know, make something special out of, you know, I mean, we were considered to be cannon fodder or like sort of, you know, literally they were trying to get me to join the army and stuff like that because I didn't have, you know, a great roster of school qualifications. So that's the council estate thing. Council estate filled with eight, going to end it now before it's too late.
And I hear you saying that punk obviously was formed as a backlash against sort of arena rock and idolizing people because there was no relatedness there. And the one thing that I always found interesting about The Damned was that even though you were really the first punk band or, you know, very influential in transforming music and introducing punk or being in that wave, you were not a political band.
Well, the first couple of albums, Brian was writing the material, and he was, I think he wrote, yeah, he wrote a song called Politics, which was, you know, where he said exactly what you said. But, you know, I do believe that, you know, you should say what you think on in your lyrics. I mean, there's nothing that bores me more than, you know, a song that has a lyric that doesn't mean anything, you know, like cut and paste lyrics.
Right.
Or, you know, something that sounds good that doesn't actually say anything whatsoever. I mean, there's bands that have done that, some very famous ones as well. And I think that's a complete waste because if you've got an audience, you know, who are listening to these songs, you're actually talking to people and it's kind of really wasted opportunity to put together some nonsensical lyric. So, yeah, I do write the odd political song. Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, there's plenty of subjects for topics, isn't there, really?
Yes, yes.
Especially at the moment with, you know, the lunatics who are running for office.
Is the Blah Party still active?
I would do it, yeah, but no, it's not running anymore. That was while Tony Blair was in power, and it was either, you know, I started my own political party basically because that lying swine kept appearing on the television, you know, talking about like sort of, you know, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could tell he was lying and most of Britain could tell he was lying. But, you know, rather than, you know, put a brick through the TV screen, I went out and started a kind of an anti-politics political party, which was basically saying that whatever you vote, nothing changes, really, because, Well, it doesn't. I mean, look, you know, I've got to a ripe old age now, and I have voted in elections, and I've really been hopeful that something might change, you know, that you might have done over in the States with Barack Obama. And then you think, hold on a second, the wars are still going on, you know. It just seems as though nothing's really changed since the last lot was in, you know?
Right.
So that's what the blah party was. It was basically saying, blah, 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 heard it all before, won't get fooled again. So that was that anyway.
So it wasn't built off of Lord Such's raving monster loony party?
Yeah, there was a tip of the hat to him, yeah. He was absolutely brilliant, Lord Such. Yeah, there's nothing politicians hate more than people who take the piss out of them, you know. And if you're standing next to a politician, I mean, they're wearing their sober suit and everything, you know, lying through their teeth, and then there's a screaming Lord Such standing next to him in a, you know, a bright kind of yellow suit with a top hat and a big pink rosette on it.
Yes.
You know, like sort of, you know, pulling faces at the politician. That really brings. They absolutely hate that, which is why it's so wonderful to do it.
You've always been the man with the smile, the one who looks like he's having the most fun. you're a great entertainer. And I read, it is written that you came up with a persona of the captain at your, like, second damn show. Was there a particular process or a reason?
Well, I can't remember any particular, you know, I just remember, you know, however outlandish I behave on stage, that was, you know, I would be the one with the photograph in the music papers the next week, rather than, like, so, you know, Dave is obviously more suave and sophisticated than I am. And, you know, Brian's, you know, he had his, and Rat. So I was basically fighting against three other kind of forceful personalities to get any column inches. And I'm an egomaniac as well, the same as the rest of them, you know. So the more crazy the outfits I wore, the more press I got. And the less the others got. It's dog eat dog in the damned, I tell you. So that's where it basically came from. Plus, you know, I always made a point of never, ever leaving one beer in the dressing room. I mean, I could not believe it when I found out, when I joined the band and all the beer was free. I mean, and you get paid as well. I mean, it's the ultimate job, you know. So anyway, I'd drink all the beer, I'd wear crazy clothes, and I'd behave like a complete buffoon, you know. And hopefully play some of the right notes at the right time, you know. But sometimes not. So it doesn't matter, does it? It's punk rock.
Exactly. At that point, you're creating as much as a spectacle. And, you know, once you start getting audience participation and people just getting so energetic and excited, it's not like a punk crowd stands there and just, you know, watches and, you know, listen to that intonation. It's about, you know, creating frenzy.
It is. The punk rock thing is really, it's a live spectacle. It's really, and the albums are really quite separate, you know. And I don't see, well, I tell you what, there's a lot of bands nowadays who, I go and watch bands all the time, and there's a real trend at the moment for perfection, you know. So much so that you get a band playing at a festival, the drummer's got his headphones on, you think, what's going on there? And he's listening to a click track because he's actually playing, he's jamming along with the band's latest CD, and which is being mixed in as they play. So you think, wow, that band sounded really good, you know, they really got it spot on. And, you know, but any musicians in the audience who, you know, they know, I didn't actually see anyone playing an acoustic guitar. Where were those backing vocals from? What's going on here? You think, they're cheating. Right, okay. You know, because the next band who goes on and doesn't cheat, you think, they sounded a bit rough. Well, they sounded rough because they weren't cheating. So, but we never cheat. You know, there's no choreography with the band or anything like that. The live thing should be live. I mean, there's no two ways about it.
Well, and the instances that you're citing really sound like four individuals instead of a band. you know, like the drummer trying to get his stuff right, but only in his head, in his world. I think, you know, about one of the successful things about The Damned is that your records are all so different. And there's so much experimentation with, you know, with sounds, with, you know, psychedelic and goth and rock. I mean, you're willing to experiment. And I'm sure that there's, you know, moments where somebody's writing credit is heavier on this song. It always seemed like it was democratic or chaotic. I don't know if those words are really interchangeable, but the feeling that the fan, I think, has always gotten from The Damned is that you're always, you know, shooting from the hip. Has there ever been a spot in the band's history where you felt like you were just going through the motions?
No, nothing's ever been planned or, you know, no, we've made all the mistakes any band could ever make, which is why we ended up on so many different record labels over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think Stiff did two albums. Chiswick Ace did, I think they did two albums. Yeah, they put up with us for two albums as well.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you know, it was single album deals all the way, really, because we didn't behave ourselves and we wouldn't do what we're told, you know. They'd say, I mean, record companies say the daftest stuff. You know, you have a track, a single that's reasonably successful, are they? And they start going, oh, why don't you write another one like that, you know? He said, well, because we've done that already, you know?
Exactly.
We want to do something else now. I said, why do you want to do that? Because, you know, that's what we do. We just do what we do. We just do what we want, and who cares? We did a track on the last album, which was called So Who's Paranoid? And
mm-hmm.
The song, it was called... the song's called Dark Asteroid, and it goes after the song is kind of, you know, first chorus, and it goes into a 15-minute psychedelic freakout. But there's been nothing like it on any Damned album before. You know, it was just because we thought, well, we haven't done one of them really. So it's absolutely remarkable piece on headphones. You know, it takes you on a total musical adventure. And you kind of, you find yourself like, sort of, wow, where, you know, where have I been for the last, you know, it's just a mind trip.
Right.
I sound like Steve Illidge or something, but it is, it's that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You should play that one, Dark Asteroid.
I will play that one. I love that. Yeah. So Who's Paranoid record. When you was the New Rose recording session the same session for the first album, or was the session for the 45 separate?
No, we did that in 2 days. We just went in this dingy studio around the back of a garage. It was just one room. It was pretty dingy and dark and not too clean, with an old 8-track tape machine. And we just banged out our set kind of until Nick Lowe thought he'd captured it. Nick Lowe was producing.
Mm-hmm.
We must have played the set about, you know, 10 times. And he took it from there, really. Well, he spent a couple of days mixing. But it was there was no special attention paid to New Rose. Well, we didn't know what the single was going to be. But help on the B-side of New Rose. We knocked that out specially. It was the Beatles had loomed large over my generation. You know, they'd them and their sugary pop songs about holding hands and all that nonsense. They did some good stuff as well. I don't want to be controversial, but they were just so darn big, you know. And the songs were so melodic that we thought we'd get our own back by ruining help on the B-side. And I deliberately detuned one of the strings on the bass, so it's actually, you know, it's quite discordant if you listen to it. The bass sounds a bit off, and that's because it is. And we don't care.
Awesome. Hey, when Brian left and you switched to guitar, was that when Lemmy stepped in on bass?
Yeah, we'd all gone off to do our solo bands. Me, Rat, and Dave. Brian had put a band together called Tans to Youth, and he was doing well. He was off and running, and the rest of us were kind of a bit slower off the mark. And we were broke as well because, you know, Brian had written all the songs on the first two albums, pretty much, and he had got the publishing advances. So we were all absolutely stone broke. And Rat phoned me up one day, said, "How's your band going, Captain?" And I said, "Ooh, you know, done a couple of gigs, haven't made any money, though. I'm absolutely skint." He said, "Look, why don't we, you know, put a lineup of the band back together and do a one-off gig in London to make a few bob?" Yeah, I said, "Hey, okay. Listen, you know, without Brian, I mean, I could go back on guitar, but because I've been a guitarist in before I joined." And I thought, who can we get on bass? And we used to spend quite a lot of time in this pub down Portobello Road. And Lemmy was always feeding the fruit machine in there. You know, it was always like, he's called Lemmy, basically. He said, can you lend me a fiver to put in the fruit machine, you know? And we asked him, and he immediately said yes, which was nice of him. So the downside was you had to, well, we were kind of sleeping on his floor while we were rehearsing, and you had to—he would wake you up. He would play Luftwaffe videos all night. You know, he'd say, "Wake up! This is a good bit. Oi, you're missing it. Oi, Captain, come on, wake up, you lazy bastard." So you have to stay up watching his World War II films, which he was obsessed with.
Yes. Rumor has it has been said. So was he only the bass player for the Dam for those particular gigs?
Couple of gigs, yeah, and then we got Al G. Ward in. We needed someone with an equally kind of uncompromising bass technique. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, "Well, you want to get Al G. Ward in? He played with the Saints, and he plays with a metal pick, and he's got the most." You know, when we heard it, we couldn't believe it. I mean, you listen to the intro of Love Song.
Oh yeah.
And you think to yourself, "Wow, how does he get that sound?" You know, it's just incredible. So, yeah, Algy was absolutely brilliant. That lineup was fantastic as well. Then we moved on to Paul Gray, you know, once again, another genius of the bass guitar. I often, like, laugh about it, really, because I'm probably the fifth or sixth best bass player who's ever been in the band. I've certainly come after those two, and Patricia Morrison was better than I am. Yeah, so there you go.
Wasn't Henry Badowski in the band also?
Henry was brilliant. Yeah, he was great fun as well. Total. I mean, who can say what the band would have done with that lineup?
Right.
Because Henry can really write a song,
mm-hmm.
and he's totally eccentric.
Whatever came of him?
I speak to him occasionally. He still writes songs, but he had an album on A&M as well. Life is a Grand, the album.
Okay.
It's just an amazing collection of songs, and really kind of beautifully crafted, kind of cheesy 80s pop.
Mm-hmm.
And it still sounds fresh now. Yeah, Henry's another pop genius, you know.
So the legacy of bass players goes and goes and goes, and now you've got, yeah, Stu is playing bass with you guys.
Yeah,
yeah.
And we had Bryn Merrick, of course. Bryn,
yes.
Who sadly passed away. Not so long ago, you know.
Yeah.
he was fantastic, and he presided over possibly the most successful period of the Damned, you know, when they had Eloise and
right.
Phantasmagoria and Alone Again Aura and all those
mm-hmm.
all those other songs. That, you know, so he's certainly a better bass player than I was.
And then for you, Will, what was it like for you in between your Damned stints, because you had tremendous commercial success? With Happy Talk, and were you actually just planning to like take a hiatus, or?
Yeah, I know it's really unlikely. Sounding, I'm not the you know, I'm a pretty unlikely pop star. Oh, I was anyway. It just happened that I had a bunch of really melodic tunes that were obviously inappropriate for the Damned, and so I had these demos and. We played them to this bloke who was in a band called New Music, who'd had a couple of kind of really brilliantly crafted kind of 80s synth pop hits. And he said, oh, I think I can do something with them. You know, there's some downtime in Mitcham around the corner. Let's go down there, you know, and work through the night and knock them into shape. So we did, and they were sounding really good. And he got a record deal for me. And the next thing you know is I'm at number one in the charts with some damned rejects, you know. So, I mean, then the career just went from strength to strength. And I was number one in France for 7 weeks. And I was all over Europe and doing promo. And I was burning the candle at both ends as well. You know, I'd be doing a TV in the morning in Britain and flying out to do a lunchtime thing in Switzerland or somewhere, and then back to do a gig with the Damned in the evening. And after a year and a half of that, I was an absolute wreck, you know, because, you know, to do that, you need the kind of, you need something to keep you going.
You need a staff of people and some good drugs.
Yeah, allegedly. And the booze didn't help either. So I ended up emotionally exhausted to stay. Found myself at the end of that, you know, it was highly successful and really fun, but I was an absolute wreck, and I had to take a couple of years off, which coincided with, you know, no pop career, no damn career, and, you know, and also the tax man sent his inevitable bills in. Found myself bankrupt, you know, and I had a young family. We just started, so I had young kids, and you know, bailiffs banging on the door saying, "I'm sorry, Mr. Burns, I'm afraid we're going to have to repossess your house." So yeah, so that was the end of the 80s for me. It was a barrel load of laughs.
Wow. Looking at it now, so what kind of growth did you experience from there?
Well, I just carried on. I never, you know, you don't take these things for granted, that you've got some right to be standing on stage in front of thousands of people. And so I started playing in the pub around the corner and, you know, just getting by any way you can, really. I seem to remember them being really happy times as well. You just get through, don't you, whatever.
So what matters to you outside of music?
I just love to travel, and I'm a bit of a foodie, well, a lot of a foodie. Let's tell the truth here. We go, me and Mrs. Sensible, we go off to Italy and Germany. We love south of Germany, Bavaria and that. And we go down sampling the wheat beers and down to Salzburg and singing the Sound of Music. as you're walking through the park, you know, sozzled on wheat beer. It's just really fun. And in Italy, of course, you know, we go down to Napoli and we eat, you know, the original pizzas. You know, there's really kind of really thin crust, kind of little works of art that can't come out of the ovens.
Yes.
And they just throw the ingredients on. It's, you know, it's not, you know, every pizza that comes out of these ovens is like a completely different shape. You know, some of them are really contorted, some of them, you know, scorched at the sides or whatever. And you know, it's not precise art, you know, it's just, but that's the great thing about Naples pizza. It's, you know, it's just rough and ready, but it's the best in the world. So
it is.
Yeah, we go down there in Portugal, we go over there to eat the pasta de natas, which is a custard tart. They specialize in cakes in Portugal.
Hmm.
The beer's not very good, but the wine's fantastic. And you can get a litre of wine for, like, sort of, you know, 50 cents or something.
Nice.
You can't complain about that, can you? Yeah, we just love to travel. That's what we do. When we're not traveling, I'm gigging.
What's your favorite pizza topping, Captain Sensible?
I think less is more, you know. And I just like a margarita or something, and sometimes with an egg cracked on the top. Yeah, really kind of minimal stuff. We all know the chain pizza restaurants, you know, that throw so many toppings on, you know, it looks, you don't know what flavors you're tasting. Yeah, less is more with pizza.
Mm. Is there any food, when you come to the U.S., is there anything that you seek out? Any restaurants or New York or L.A. traditional food or anything?
I was a vegetarian. It used to be really difficult in the States, but people are discovering that sort of thing through, you know, the health food side of life. But really, I just go to the... I mean, what is really remarkable about the States is the way that beer has come on. I remember 40 years ago, when I came out to do a tour, I would pack my suitcase with cans and cans and cans of British beer. And,
really?
You know, I just couldn't... Yeah, I did. It was so heavy. I mean, those were the days when you could... You know, there was no weight restrictions, you know, when you flew anywhere. I mean, they were... Can you imagine? Everyone used to, you know, take loads of... You know, take whatever you want, you know, and if you took five suitcases, it didn't cost you any more.
Right.
As soon as you got on the plane, you'd smoke a packet of cigarettes, then you... You know, it was just amazing, you know, how crazy it was. I mean, because everyone breathes that air in, don't they?
Yes.
It's not going to go anywhere. So the smoking zone and the non-smoking zone doesn't mean anything, does it?
No.
But anyway, yeah, but the beer has really changed in America so much for the better, you know, with this craft beer thing. I know it's, you know, you could accuse it of being a bit, you know, poncy or whatever, but it tastes so darn good, especially compared to like Bud Light or Miller or Coors or Schlitz or whatever we had to drink before, you know, about 10 or 15 years ago. So, yeah, I don't have to bring my own beer now, and that's absolutely fantastic. I go down to craft beer place, wherever you are, you know, and I order, you know, a tray of like sort of, you know, sampler tray, and whichever one I like best, I'll have a few pints of. Yeah, it's nice now.
Yeah. And then that's the, is that one of the requests that you have for backstage also?
We do. We have local brews, yeah, local IPAs on the rider, yeah. And maybe if they can find them some stouts, the chocolate porter or a coffee stout or something, would be nice.
Last time I saw you guys, I guess it was a couple of years ago, and you DJ'd after the Irving Plaza show. Is that something that you're planning to do again?
I am, yeah. I'm DJing down the Beauty Bar once again after the first night. After the Gramercy, the first night, I'm rushing straight off to play some of my favourite glam and punk songs. I love glam rock. I mean, you know, it's no surprise. I mean, that's where my wacky image came from, I guess. I mean, you know, when you were sitting at home practicing, you know, in 1974, and you thought, oh, you know, I can't wait till I'm on stage doing, you know, what my heroes are doing. And your heroes were the bands that were famous at the time, which were glam rock bands, you know, Slade and Status Quo and Sweet and T-Rex and, you know, and stuff like that. So I imagined that, you know, by the time I ended up in a band, it would be a glam rock band. How wrong was I? But the thing is, punk and glam don't sound too much different. It's got that glorious 70s sound to it. If you didn't know, if you played a couple of punk songs, you know, from 77, back to back with a couple of glam songs from 74 maybe, you know, Come On Feel the Noise by Slade, or, you know, Ballroom Blitz by The Sweet, and then like Into the Valley by The Skids, and then something by The Buzzcocks, you know, Ever Falling in Love, you know. And if you play those four tracks together to, you know, a youngster, and instead, pick out the punk songs, you can't really tell the difference. So it just makes for a really good, fun DJ, this disco experience, I think.
Didn't you guys open for T-Rex?
We did, yeah.
What was that
Mark
like?
Well, we got him at a good time when he'd been through his superstar phase, and he was kind of having a comeback, if you like. And he was a bit more humble, so he was really nice and approachable. In fact, he picked us. He saw a picture of me wearing a T-Rex T-shirt, and the punk thing was like sort of, it was obviously this new, you know, this thing was here to stay, and he was shrewd enough to grab himself a punk rock band as his support act, and he chose us because I was wearing one of his T-shirts. But he was really nice to us. He paid for our hotels, and we travelled on the same tour bus as him.
Wow.
And his band, and you know, we just used to mingle, and it was just a really joyous experience, especially for a T-Rex fan, you know.
Yeah.
He really looked after us. He'd give us advice and tell us, you know, things about studios and, you know, songwriting and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, he was really, really, really helpful. Yeah, really good bloke.
Oh, that's a wonderful memory. Wow. I'm hearing you smiling while you're talking about Mark Bolan. Do you have any other recollections of somebody who gave you advice that you that really made a difference to you?
You know, back in those days when punk was new and not everybody liked it, you know, it was really nice for people like Mark Bolan and Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy,
mm-hmm.
And Lemmy and a couple of others. You know, it was really nice of them to, you know, come down. And I mean, Phil Lynott used to lend me his bass guitar if I broke a string or something. I never had any spares because, you know, I wasn't that together. So, you know, some of the old guard really dug punk, you know, and they could see it was similar to maybe what, you know, there was nothing really that radically different. And we were all like sort of, you know, musical pirates, aren't we, basically? Mm-hmm. Well, the Rolling Stones sent us cakes, didn't they? When we did our first gig in New York, I think Keith Richards arranged for they sent a few cakes down and a couple of strumpets to bring them into the dressing room, which was very nice of him.
Did you actually eat them or smash them?
I mean, we probably ate some of it. You know, mm-hmm. The rest of it probably went flying. Yeah.
Well, which has me, of course, bring to mind the first LP, the pie shoot and the poster. They play it at your sister. Whose idea was that to just smash each other with pies?
Absolutely no idea. It certainly wasn't mine, because when I when they told me we were making an album, I thought, oh, that's nice, you know. Your ambition as a young musician is to make an album. And, you know, I wasn't as confident as maybe I should have been that we would have lasted longer than one record. I mean, we lasted 40 years after all, you know. But I thought, well, this might be the only record I ever make, so at least I want a nice picture of me on the front cover. I can show my auntie Sadie up in Glasgow, you know, and say, look, auntie, I did actually make a record. So, you know, when they covered us with cakes and all that gunge and everything the studio, I think it was Brian's girlfriend's idea. It wasn't even the record label's idea.
Mm.
So you know, so I saw the front cover and I thought, yeah, it was pretty dramatic stuff. You can't actually see my face,
right?
And then I turned it over and I saw the picture on the back. I had my back turned to the camera.
Yes.
So it's a live shot on the back cover. So I was really angry. I said, no. I've got to do something about this. So the bloke putting the cover together, he sent me off to Paddington Station with a pound and said, look, get yourself some passport photos. And they cut one of them out and put it on the back cover on the side of one of the stage monitors.
Right, exactly.
So that's why that little picture's there, because I was so distraught that you can't see my face on the record sleeve.
So
you can now.
There you go. Oh, that's awesome. That's great. So were there stylists in there, like pushing the frosting around on your head and stuff, or?
No, it was just Brian's girlfriend was just like going for it. it was really there was shaving foam in there. I think some baked beans, some cake. Flans that the gunge went in, they were quite tasty, but you know, the shaving foam was not too good.
Right I can imagine. Hey, on your you have a Pledge Music page where you offered up some Skype guitar lessons. Have you done those yet?
No, not yet. I don't know how to do this Pledge thing. Mm-hmm. When they get in touch with me, I'll go for it. Yeah, I'm just gonna, you know, I mean, me giving guitar lessons, I mean, I'm a bluffer, let's face it. you know, it's been getting away with it for years. I just throw my fingers around, you know, and hope some of the right notes come out.
Mm-hmm.
But if people, you know, have pledged to have a guitarist, and I'll just show them whatever they, you know, any track they want to know how to play or whatever. I don't know any scales. I've never had a guitar lesson myself.
Mm.
It's all like sort of, you know, as I said, bluff. And I listen to a lot of Jimi Hendrix and the Groundhogs and, you know, some of the early 70s, you know, Sabbath and stuff like that. And some of it kind of, you know, got in my head and stayed there. And, you know, but it's not, I don't know, I couldn't tell you the scales. No ideas. So it's going to be interesting doing the guitar lessons. But yeah, you just throw your fingers around, you know.
No damned cover bands coming out of those lessons right away. And so then back to the 40th anniversary. Your retrospective career spanning sets, the Brighton Museum, you're contributing an outfit and a guitar for the Photo Punk exhibition.
Yeah, I've given them the guitar. They've got it. It's the oldest one that I've got, and it's really kind of amazing that it's still in one piece, because it's been set on fire and attacked with an axe. And it's just really beaten up, and the scratch plate, you know, is broken, and the pickups have been changed, and yeah, it's just it's a wreck. But it actually still plays, you know, and it's got like sort of cartoons of I think there's one on the back of me saying Cliff Richard is if I remember correctly. so it's just covered with slogans and rubbish like that. Yeah, that's good. And one of my furry outfits.
Oh, nice.
Probably pongs a bit, because I don't think it's been washed for 30 years. But it's funny, isn't it, to be in a museum? Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Well, it's all a celebration, and it's all, I like to think of it as sort of like a worldwide thank you, you know, to the accomplishments that you guys have made. Even though it's clear, and from talking to you and just from seeing, I think, the band's demeanor over the years, that you were not planning on world domination or anything like it. It was just sort of like, well, let's see what happens, you know. And I just love the spirit that it seems that you guys operate within, having fun and entertaining. And really, in it, you've transformed modern music as a byproduct of having fun and being vivacious and unique. You guys are just an amazing band and an amazing live. I think that all your shows are sold out, the New York and the LA shows, aren't they?
Yeah, kind of. All those accolades, blimey. Thank you very much. But, you know, I mean, we're just blundering through somehow, and, you know, No, it's fun, and I really enjoy it.
Well, you've been wandering through for 40 years, you know, so I get to say thank you to you for everybody else. Your music is wonderful. You stand wildly for what can be. Like, you can have fun up here. This is what it's all about, you know, and I just love seeing that and seeing you perform, and yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's you know, and also the fun thing, really. I mean, I just never understood these bands. You know, take themselves seriously, and you know, and behaving like rock gods or something like that is absolute nonsense. And like, sort of, you know, giving it the cool thing in front of the camera, and like, you know, where's my minders and my limousine and all that? It's just nonsense, you know. It's just unnecessary. They're just people like sort of twanging the guitar or whatever. You know, they're nothing special. It doesn't make you any different from any other human being on the planet. You know, a bloke who, you know, who fixes the tap in your bathroom, you know, I mean, if he does a good job, then he's as good as his job as you are, maybe, you know, writing a song. But it doesn't make you any better as a human being, does it? I mean, I always felt kind of it's part of our job, really, to be the antidote to all that kind of pompousness.
You guys have the right spirit, creating in the moment and having fun and really being there for the audience. You're one of the most entertaining bands and always great live, you know, with whatever lineup. That's one thing that I've seen that you have always really, really stood for. It's like entertainment at its best. You do a good job.
Old Vanian can certainly sing, you know. He's still got it. He's probably the best, you know, singer of his generation, really. You know, it's really nice as a songwriter to, you know, to get in the studio and after you've done your feeble attempt at the demo, you know, where I sing it myself, you know, and then you hear a proper singer kind of doing his interpretation of it, and it's always like I stand on the other side of the screen, you know, sort of, it just makes you feel real good, you know. You're really lucky to have a decent singer in your band.
And you had mentioned earlier that Brian wrote everything on the first two records, so were you surprising yourselves after he wasn't in the band, like, oh, we can do this?
Yeah. Yeah, we were expected to, you know, fade away and disappear without our glorious leader at the controls. Amazingly, we discovered we could all write, you know. Dave could write, I could write, and so could Rat.
Yeah.
So it was a surprise to us as much as anyone else. And
surprise!
Yeah, there's a lot more music in this band than, you know, we were given credit for it, and a lot to say as well. We had plenty to say, and still have. You know, still we're going to do something completely different next year musically. We're going to on this album that we've just started writing.
Do you have a working title for it?
No. But it's another one. We're going to dare to be different once again. Each album's got to sound different. It still have elements of the Damned in there, you know. It'll have its kick-ass moments and you know, its dark tinges and an element of psychedelia and, like, sort of a bit of freak beat in there. But, you know, there'll be a few surprises.
Awesome. When you said now for something completely different, was it deliberate that you got somebody that looked like John Cleese in your What video?
No, he just did the uptight hotel manager better than any kind of piss take I've ever seen.
That's a faulty.
It's just perfect, because I've stayed in so many hotels in so many countries where the proprietor has been exactly like that, you know, when you know, you complain about something. That kind of thing was just perfect for the What video, because it's a true story, the What thing. I'd been up all night drinking. I hold my hands up, tell the truth. I kept the bar going till about 6 or 7 in the morning. I thought to myself, crikey, if I don't get some sleep now, you know, the tour manager's going to be banging on my door at 10:30 to get in the van, you know, to get to the next gig. So I went, jumped into bed, and no sooner had my head hit the pillow than a building site across the road started up, and this bloody noise erupted, you know, this pile driver. It was just incessant. I stuck my head under the pillow, it didn't work, and I called reception, but to no avail. That's why I'm telling you, know, and it became the song wrote itself, basically. And that was the same. I actually recorded the sound of the pile driver on my recording Walkman.
Really?
Walkman. I took it down to the reception, and I said, get me the manager, you know, and this bloke comes out, a bit like Basil Fawlty, put the cassette player up to his ear. I said, listen to this. And I played him the pile driver, and he said, well, you shouldn't have been up drinking all night, should you? So it was something like that. So yeah. he had a point, I suppose. But anyway, so, yeah, you get back to Britain, I played the recording of the pile driver to the producer, and we made that song out of it. So out of that kind of crazy story and that kind of jokey kind of song, it was my most successful song. ever, really. So that was the one that was number one in 7 weeks in Paris, in France. So you never know. Some of the tunes I wrote that I spent weeks and weeks on, nobody knows. So you never know what's going to be successful and what's not, really.
Right. What's your favorite Damn song?
Oh, at the moment I like a song called Ignite. Mm. Yeah, that's really fun. I remember they borrowed a Fender Stratocaster for that one, and I didn't like it because the volume control is right next to the pickups on a Fender Strat. So I kept inadvertently turning the volume off mid solo, so I keep retaking and retaking. I've always loathed and detested Stratocasters, but for that reason. But they sound great, but you'd need to completely redesign one to get them to be playable for an SG man like myself.
Whose idea was it to do the scratch and sniff strawberry insert on that LP that Bronze put out?
Oh, that came from the song title, from the album title, Strawberries, which is an abbreviation of a Strawberries for Pigs, or Giving Strawberries to a Pig, which was basically, we played some of those songs and some new material, and we got a bit of a slagging from one or two of the British music journalists who thought we were kind of being a bit adventurous for a punk group, you know. I mean, yeah, it depends on your interpretation of punk. If your idea of punk is like sort of you just play one dimensional kind of, you know, three chord songs, you know, lasting 2 minutes about, you know, all sound the same for the rest of your career, then sure, we weren't punk rock anymore. But that wasn't my interpretation of punk, which was to be as adventurous as you possibly could with like sort of the resources that you had, you know, to make something special every time to be the best you possibly can be. And, you know, and the fashion was the same. You know, none of us had any money. You'd go down a charity shop and you'd get like an old suit or something. You'd cut the sleeve off and you'd put something else in it, or you'd safety pin it up. And, you know, you'd mix and match like sort of really unlikely bits of clothing and put these stupendous outfits together that you'd wear down the Roxy Club or whatever. And, you know, that was the great thing about punk. You didn't need money. You just needed a bit of creativity. So, so don't tell me to dumb down. I won't do it for anybody, you know. And I don't believe that is punk anyway, you know. So anyway, we were doing these more adventurous kind of tunes, and we got a bit of a slag in. So we decided to call the album Giving Strawberries to a Pig. but we abbreviated it because it was a bit of a mouthful. So that's where the strawberry scent came from. Some people have got albums that still smell of strawberries as well.
Mine does.
Kind of nice. Is it really?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you have to know that it was there and to kind of look for it with your nose, but it is there. I took it out yesterday just to check it out, and I did. And I looked at the matrix, and scrawled onto the matrix one side it says strawberries, and the other one it says for pigs.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Is that on now? I'll have to dig mine out and have a look. Yeah.
Do you still collect vinyl?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. I do, and I find myself because I've worn out a few records over the years. But you know, you come back from the pub and maybe you scratch a record or something. I'd like to have really pristine copies and, you know, first editions and stuff, first pressings. So I do spend more than I should on vinyl, but I've still got the same record collection that I had, you know, which spans between about 65 and 1985. For me, though, you know, everyone loves the music they grew up with, basically. But I've just renewed some of them, you know, just bought better versions over the years. So
nice.
I do always on the lookout for a really beautiful, like, sort of first press.
Congratulations, I guess we say congratulations on an anniversary, 40th anniversary of New Rose.
Oh, right. It's really strange because, I just find that interviews really, I don't never talk about myself or if, you know, like sort of, you know, weeks and weeks. And then because this anniversary of New Rose is coming up, you have to, you know, it's like, in the nicest possible way, it's like getting dragged through a hedge backwards because you go through all these memories, And some of them are really intense. And, you know, I mean, flashing through my mind is all the pictures of, you know, when I mentioned the punch-ups in the studio and, you know, and sleeping on people's floors in, you know, 1976, you know, and so it was, yeah, sleeping on Lemmy's floor. I mean, the pictures all flood back to me, you know.
Right.
And, you know, as soon as I put the phone down now, I'll be...
You won't know where you are.
I'll have to come back. Yeah, exactly. I'll have to come back to reality, and, you know, and...
Well, thank you for getting a look into Captain Sensible's time machine.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm particularly looking forward to the DJing as well, because it's really, you know, the... Because once, you know, once we've done the gig and that, you know, it's all the pressure's off. You can go down and just let your hair down and play some crazy punk and glam.
There you go.
And get some T-Rex going.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for talking to us. And congratulations. And have a great few shows. And thank you for everything that you have. Saying that you've done for music sounds a little bit grandiose. But there really has been a shift in what we listen to now because of your contribution. So I do want to thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. We didn't quite get rid of Phil Collins, but we had a good go. Anyway, cheers. Nice to talk to you, Diane.
All right. Thank you.
Cheers.
Have a good day.
Bye.
And that wraps it up. Diane Kamikaze for WFMU. Thanks to Captain Sensible. Thanks to Joe Murray for arranging the interview. Support the Damned in any way possible. Support WFMU in any way possible. All the info can be found on WFMU.org.